Welcome back to The Mountain Life, Healthy Living in the Wasatch. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with Tim Henney. Well, the gathering of big data tells us lots of things that we may have intuitively sort of already knew, but it is fun to have those things confirmed, validated, and then even expanded into tidbits that we didn't in fact already know. Perfect timing, as it turns out, is a science, and our guest, best-selling author Daniel Pink, joins us to discuss his popular book, which is now out in paperback. It's called When, The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. Did you know, for example, that you ought not ever schedule surgery or take an important test in the afternoon? And there's plenty of science to back that up. Dan Pink, welcome to The Mountain Life. Nice to have you.
Good to be here. Thanks for having me.
So, Dan, we spoke to you last year. We've spoken to you a handful of times when you come out with these wonderful books. You're one of our favorite people to talk to.
Well, thanks.
But last year we talked to you on our science show, and we love talking about algorithms and big data. But The Mountain Life is more about, you know, mental health and wellness and nutrition. And I just want to start off by making the statement that these ginormous sets of big data, what you're daylighting in your book is kind of a follow-up to what we knew by intuition, isn't it? But now you're really proving, you know, the proof is in the numbers.
Yeah, I mean, it's such a great point, particularly your this idea about big data. Big data, I mean, at some level, it's my view is that it's overhyped in the short run and underhyped in the long run. But what it's allowing is researchers to see patterns that otherwise would have been invisible. And sometimes these patterns are consistent with our intuition; other times they're not. And when it comes to timing, big data has given us some very interesting insights into how our mood and how our brain power changes over the course of the day. And one of the things that it's found is that we move through the day typically in three stages: a peak, a trough, a recovery. Most of us move through the day in that order: our peak in the morning, our trough in the early to mid-afternoon, and our recovery in the late afternoon and early evening. About 20% of us who are night owls actually have our peak much, 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 much later in the day, well into the evening. But we perform differently at these different stages of the day because our brains are different and our mood is different.
Well, let's go into first, before we talk about all the bad things that can happen and do happen in hospitals and educational institutions during that trough, let's talk about what, well, one of my favorite topics, and Tim, I know, loves the siesta. Let's talk about napping and how it can help us with that trough and what the recovery is.
Sure. So what we know is well, just to widen things out a little bit, during the peak, we're most vigilant, and that makes it the best time to do analytic work, work that requires heads-down focus and attention. During the recovery, which is later in the day, some of this big data research has showed us is that our mood is back up, but we're less vigilant. And that actually is a pretty interesting combination, that good mood and some mental looseness makes it a good time for brainstorming certain kinds of creative tasks. But the trough that you mentioned is a really bad time of day. We don't perform very well there. And one of the remedies we have for that, as you say, are breaks and, in particular, naps. There's an enormous amount of research on naps, and it shows that naps are actually pretty good for us. But the ideal nap is much, much, much shorter than I would have ever imagined. The ideal nap during that trough period is very short, about 10 to 20 minutes long. When you nap longer than that, you begin to develop what's called sleep inertia, which is that groggy, boggy feeling you get when you emerge from a nap. But really short naps, 10 to 20 minutes long, have a profound effect on restoring our mental sharpness and on even on restoring our mood, restoring our energy levels.
So funny that the Spanish government eliminated the siesta, trying
to
be more like us Americans. And
yeah.
And they found that it just didn't work because productivity suffered.
Well, this is one of those areas where, again, we have intuition. Sometimes our intuitions match up to the science. Other times that they don't. Now, I think one of the things is, like, I think it's unlikely that, you know, we're gonna, like, the United States should or can move toward a full-fledged siesta where everybody in America takes a three-hour break in the middle of the afternoon to have a giant plate of paella and three glasses of red wine. That's probably not going to hold up for very long. But what the research tells us is that we should be taking more breaks for our mental and physical health, and we should be taking certain kinds of breaks. So naps are one kind of break, but you know, not everybody can nap on the job. So there are other kinds of breaks that we can take that the science is telling us are enormously effective. So one thing we know is that breaks with other people are often more restorative than breaks on our own, that breaks outside are often better than breaks inside, that breaks where we are moving are better than breaks when we are stationary, and that breaks where we are fully detached, that is, we don't have our nose in our social media feed, are more restorative than breaks where we are, you know, even semi-detached. And again, the performance differences during that trough are so profound that one of the great remedies that we have is simply taking a break. And this is one of those areas where we've gotten it entirely wrong, especially in America. We have this very puritanical notion that the way to get more work done, the way to get better work done, is to power through. That when we power through, that's not only effective, but it's also, you know, morally virtuous. And the research is telling us that is nonsense. People need breaks, and I really believe that if the productivity in America would increase, if every afternoon people took, around America's workplaces, took a 10 to 15 minute walk outside with someone they liked, without their phones, talking about something other than work, I think you'd see a productivity boom in America.
Daniel, I think I can confirm, as Lynn referenced, I do like my siesta, but I've come to like it. I didn't like it in my earlier years. I never used to nap, and I had much more of the kind of power-through mentality, but I had a 9-to-5 job on Wall Street, so I didn't really have a chance. Everybody was, you know, powering through together.
Right.
But definitely what you just talked about with that 10-to-20-minute nap, I can confirm and have experienced that. And sometimes it's been shocking to me where I'll sort of lay down on the couch and I'm suddenly coming out and I'm like, huh, I think I might have fallen asleep. I look at the clock and I'm like, yes, I must have, because 30 minutes have elapsed. And, you know, it takes a while to kind of drop out and then come back and all of the things that happen with a nap. But those are the ones that restore me. And that groggy thing, anything longer, and it puts me into that sleep inertia or that groggy phase that you referenced. So, yes, I can absolutely confirm that. That's not a question. But here's my question for you.
Yeah.
How about those Northwestern Wildcats this year?
You know, well, that's a question that I love talking about as a confirmed Wildcat who bleeds purple. Yes, indeed. What a great football season Northwestern had.
And I graduate.
I don't know whether Coach Fitz has, you know, mastered the art of timing, but
well, here's a timing aspect for you. So I graduated in 1980 from Northwestern, and talk about timing. When I was there, they had the longest losing streak in college football. In my 4 years, we won one game. I think that changed while you were there. So there's a timing cycle to things.
Well, a little bit. My first game, my first Northwestern football game that I went to the first week of my freshman year was the game where Northwestern beat Northern Illinois University to snap what was then the longest losing streak in college football history.
There you go.
And so students tore down the goalposts and then dumped them in Lake Michigan. So that was my experience the first week of college. So I thought college was pretty awesome.
Yeah, and I think that's the game that that was probably the last game of my, you know, tenure there. And I remember that goalpost coming down. It bonked one of my fraternity brothers in the head. We didn't even know how to tear down a goalpost, quite honestly.
Yeah, well, winning was such a shock that people didn't really know how to react.
Yeah. So, you know, what about the bigger cycles, Daniel? Because there are these little things that we can do during the day where you take a nap or you go out and you have a restorative walk with people and, you know, don't visit the hospital during the trough. And those are things that little practical aspects of our daily routine. But what about the bigger cycle? And how do the cycles tie into, you know, the tides and the orbits and our circadian rhythm, there must be a natural tempo and rhythm that's that we're trying to integrate into, and we can either resist it and fight it, or we can kind of learn how the natural cycles take place and ride them.
Well, I mean, you're exactly right that our natural cycles are part of an entire field of science called chronobiology, which is the study of our daily rhythms. And one of the things that you, one of the great points you make is that we are biological creatures, and biological creatures are subject to these diurnal rhythms. And what this means is that we are not the same throughout the day. As I mentioned before, our brain power changes, our mood changes. And one of the ways we figure out how to make it through the day is also by responding to cues in our environment, particularly light and dark. It's a process called entrainment. And so, you know, one of the things that I've discovered is in writing a lot about these kinds of topics is that there's not a fine border between psychology and biology, because we are biological creatures, and we can either embrace that and go with that and figure out the best way to do that, or pretend that it doesn't exist. And I think that's one of the problems we have in organizations. We think that all times of days are created equal, and we're not intentional about when we do things. You know, the best example of that is meetings in organizations. When we have a meeting in organizations, the only criterion we use is availability. So we don't say, what kind of meeting is this? Do we need people to be locked down and focused? Do we need people to be more creative? Is it simply an administrative meeting? We don't say, hey, who's going to be at this meeting? Is it going to be, you know, larks like Lynn or owls like Tim? We don't even ask any of those questions. We just say, hey, is Tim available? Is Lynn available? And is conference room 3C open? And if we start being intentional about these when decisions in our work and in our personal lives, we're going to feel better and we're going to do better.
Now, you know, that's an amazing example, because I think, certainly for Lynn and I, we attend a lot of meetings. I have never thought about a meeting through that lens. You're completely correct. It's always about, you know, when can this group of 10 people or 5 people, what's the availability on the schedule and time of day? And none of the effectiveness or efficiency or the troughs and peaks come into play. It's so difficult to get those 10 people together to begin with, just based on the basic calendar and availability. How could we possibly layer in this other aspect and make it a consideration, because it seems like it's so difficult to begin with?
Well, I mean, it's a tough problem to solve, but it's not an impossible problem to solve. What we need to know is we need to have a decent sense of people's chronotypes. We need to know, hey, who are the larks, who are the owls, and we also need to think more rigorously about what kind of meeting it is. And if we just simply make those two decisions, all right, we can do better. We're not going to make it perfect every time, but we can do a little bit better. So, for instance, if you want people to be, let's take brainstorming, for instance, all right? A lot of organizations have brainstorming meetings. It's pretty darn clear that you shouldn't do a brainstorming meeting at 2 o'clock in the afternoon. It's a very, very bad idea. If you have an office full of people who are more morning people, actually, it's better not to do brainstormings at 9 o'clock in the morning. What you're better off doing is brainstormings in brainstorming meetings late in the afternoon. And so if you know it's a certain kind of meeting, then just find a time, any time in that late afternoon, and do it then. But again, for whatever reason, we just haven't gotten the message that when we do things matters not more than what we do or how we do it, but just as much. And we see this across essentially every domain of performance, from sports to corporate performance to education to healthcare to judicial decision making to jury decision making. Across the board, time of day has a big effect on us, and we need to wake up to that and actually do something about it.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Daniel Pink. His book is When: The Scientific Secrets of Perfect Timing. The book came out last year in hardback. Now it's out in paperback. And we're so happy that Daniel could join us. And Daniel, I have to say, a year ago, I was telling you how the Park City School District was looking at starting school later, and all the science had come in. In fact, we have one of the nation's leading sleep experts that lives right here in town, and there was a committee, and there were, you know, they arrived at this, not a decision really, because nothing has happened in a year, but we have a new superintendent since the last time we spoke. And so what would you say to that superintendent about the timing of when you start school?
You know what? I would say to the superintendent, follow the evidence. Here's what we know. The school start times are different for different age kids. So little kids in elementary school, they can start school pretty early. But what we know about biology is that around the mid-teens, all the way through the mid-20s, there is a massive move toward lateness. People's chronotypes change, sometimes by 2, 3, even 4 hours. And this is one reason why for teenagers, school starts too early. This is not just my opinion. This is what this mountain of evidence tells us. It's why the American Academy of Pediatrics has implored school districts around the country, do not start school before 8:30 in the morning for teenagers. And yet most schools still start way earlier than that. And what we also know from the school districts that around 15% of school districts have changed, what we've seen from school districts that have pushed back their start times for teenagers, we're not talking about starting school at noon. We're talking about moving the start time from 7:45 to 9:15, right? We're talking about starting school at 9:15, 9:30. What these districts have seen are lower dropout rates, higher test scores, less teen depression, and actually in some interesting research out in your part of the country, in the West, a pretty significant decline in car accidents among teenagers.
Oh, that doesn't surprise me.
It also turns out to be a very cost-effective way to improve performance in a school district. The problem is that it's inconvenient for parents because if they have kids who are in elementary school and in middle school and high school, mm-hmm. they want to drop everybody off at the same time. And coaches hate it too because it delays up. It starts eating into after-school athletic practice. And superintendent, I had one superintendent tell me, hey, you're right, but when I became superintendent, they told me there are three things I couldn't mess with: bells, balls, and buses. And yeah. School start times affect all three of those things. But maybe your superintendent will be steely and follow the science, and your students will benefit from it.
Well, certainly that has been the community discussion around convenience and things like after-school jobs and older students needing to take care of their younger siblings and all
sure.
kinds of things like that. But in these massive studies that you cite in your book, I'm curious about that, athletic teams practicing perhaps in the morning. Would something like that work and wake the kids up so that they're more alert for school?
Yeah, it's a very interesting idea. Again, for teenagers, it probably doesn't make a huge amount of sense because teenagers, are just, I got a 16-year-old son, all right? At 7:45 when he walks to school, he is not fully awake. But his school starts at 8:10, and that's when he has to be there. And so I'm not sure, he'll be any more alert on the basketball court at that time rather than in the classroom. But there are for the rest of us, when we exercise, for instance, different times of day have different effects on our exercise. So, for instance, exercising in the morning is very, very good if you want to lose weight. It's good if you want to lose weight, if you want to establish a habit. It's a good mood booster. But afternoon exercise is also valuable. Afternoon exercise, depending on your goals, afternoon exercise is people tend to enjoy it more. People have fewer injuries. And actually, our performance goes up. And so even a question like that, like when in the day should you work out, there's evidence telling us which way to go.
Daniel, I'm curious about how timing may have been identified as other things in our culture. And I'm thinking about the saying, I'd rather be lucky than smart. Seems
yeah.
like they could pull out lucky and put in, I'd rather have good timing than be smart.
Yeah, you know what? I mean, that's... There's some truth to that. It's a different way of thinking about timing. Some timing is just luck, randomness, fate. And luck and randomness play a larger role in our lives than we're willing to admit. What I'm saying in this research is that, yeah, I mean, we do. There is an enormous amount of randomness in our lives, but there's also elements that we can control. We can have a tighter grip on when we do things in the course of a day. We can be more aware of how beginnings affect us. We can be more aware of how midpoints affect us, how endings affect us, how groups synchronize in time. But sure, some of life is purely random.
Well, let's talk about the timing of hand washing in a hospital setting, for example. I always think of this study, not that from your book, but a study that shows that when people come out of the restroom in a public restroom and there's no one else there, they often don't wash their hands if there's a hidden camera looking at their behavior. So that always prompts me to wash my hands, even if I'm alone. I think, oh, there's the hidden camera. But you talk about how hand washing really drops off in hospital settings in the afternoon, again, in the trough.
Absolutely, and this is part of a larger body of research showing that in general, if you can avoid it, avoid going to hospitals in the afternoon. The study you're talking about is from Brad Stotz at UNC and Katie Milkman at the University of Pennsylvania that showed across a few thousand hospitals, a massive decrease in hand washing in the afternoons. Which is dangerous because hand washing in hospitals is the first line of defense against hospital-acquired infections. But you also see things like anesthesia errors are four times more likely in hospitals at 3 p.m. than at 9 a.m. You see in colonoscopies, doctors find half as many polyps in afternoon exams as they do in morning exams. You see doctors prescribing way more unnecessary antibiotics in afternoon appointments than in morning appointments. And so, again, time of day matters. Now, the good news in some of this is that there are remedies. So, for instance, in that nurses study, the hand-washing study, one of the remedies was to give nurses more breaks, in particular social breaks. That ended up increasing the rates of hand-washing, which had deteriorated in the afternoon.
Wow. Well, another reason that you ought to go outside and do that walking break, leave your phone behind, wash your hands upon return. It all ties together in the scientific secrets of perfect timing. Our guest, Daniel Pink, and his book, When. Dan, thanks so much for joining us again. We can't wait till your next book. And is there a next book?
I'm working on it. not very much, though. But thanks for having me back. It's always a pleasure talking to you.
All right. Thanks, Dan. Take care.